The pregnant 14-year-old in your school was not exactly a walk in the park. Bernard's tone turned dismissive. It wasn't that bad. Matthew Levy agreed.
These spats are always cyclical. They tear into each other one week, then the next week they're best friends and they hate someone else. You see it all the time.
All the women in the room seemed to think otherwise. Park spoke for them.
It was bad, she said. I'd say that within a month of enrolling, Kayla Alexander had crossed just about everybody here. She split the school in two.
Was she popular with the boys?
And how? Park said. She used them like toilet paper.
Was there anyone in particular?
There was a series of shrugs and head shaking.
The list is probably endless, Bernard supplied, but the boys didn't rile up. They knew what they were getting.
Faith addressed Daniela Park.
Earlier you made it sound like Emma was her only friend.
Park answered, Kayla was Emma's friend. Emma was all Kayla had left.
The distinction was an important one.
Why did Emma stick by her?
Only Emma knows the answer to that, but I would guess that she understood what it meant to be an outsider. The more things turned against Kayla, the closer they seemed to get.
You said the school was divided in two. What exactly happened?
Silence filled the room.
No one seemed to want to volunteer the information. Faith was about to ask the question again when Paolo Wolf, an economics teacher who had been quiet until this point, said, Mary Clark would know more about that. The silence became more pronounced until Evan Bernard mumbled something under his breath. Faith asked,
I'm sorry, Mr. Bernard, I didn't catch what you said.
His eyes darted around the room as if to dare anyone to challenge him.
Mary Clark barely knows the time of day.
Is Mary a student here?
McFadden, the principal, explained,
Mrs. Clark is one of our English teachers. She had Kayla in her class last year.
Faith didn't bother to ask why the woman wasn't here. She would find out for herself in person.
Can I speak with her?
McFadden opened her mouth to respond, but the bell rang. The principal waited until the ringing had stopped.
That's the assembly bell, she told Faith. We should head over to the auditorium. I really need to talk to Mary Clark.
There was just a second of equivocation before McFadden gave a bright smile that would rival the world record for fakeness.
I'd be happy to point her out to you.
Faith walked across the courtyard behind the main school building, following Olivia McFadden and the other teachers to the auditorium. Oddly, they were all in a single line, as were all the students following their respective teachers to the assembly. The building was the most modern-looking of all the structures on the Westfield campus, probably built on the backs of hapless parents shilling candy bars, magazine subscriptions, and wrapping paper to unsuspecting neighbors and grandparents. One line of students in particular was getting a bit too rowdy. McFadden's head swiveled around as if it were on a turret, her gaze pinpointing the loudest culprits. The noise quickly drained, like water down a sink. Faith should not have been surprised by the auditorium, which was really more like what you would find housing a small community theater in a wealthy suburb. Rows of plush velvet red seats led to a large stage with state-of-the-art lighting hanging overhead. The barrel-vaulted ceiling was painted in a very convincing homage to the Sistine Chapel. Intricate bas-relief around the stage depicted the gods in various states of excitement. The carpet underfoot was thick enough to make Faith glance down every few steps for fear of falling. McFadden gave the tour as she walked, students hushing in her wake. We built the auditorium in 1995 with an eye toward hosting overflow events during the Olympics. So, the parents had hustled their candy, then the school had charged the state to rent the auditorium.
Daphne, no gum, McFadden told one of the girls as she passed.
She directed her words back to Faith.
Our art director, Mrs. Myers, suggested the ceiling motif.
Faith glanced up, mumbling, Nice. There was more about the building, but Faith tuned out McFadden's voice as she walked down the steps toward the stage. There was a certain frisson that overtook the auditorium as it began filling with students.
Some were crying, some were simply staring at the stage, a look of expectancy in their eyes. A handful were with their parents, which somehow made the situation even more tense. Faith saw more than one child with a mother's arm around his or her shoulders. She couldn't help but think about Abigail Campano when she saw them. Remember the way the mother had so fiercely fought the man she assumed had killed her daughter. The hair on the back of her neck rose, an ancient genetic response to the sense of collective fear that permeated the room. Doing a quick count with some multiplication, Faith figured that, including the empty balcony, there were around 1,000 seats in the auditorium. The bottom level was almost completely full. Most of the Westfield students were young girls. The majority of them were very thin, very well-heeled, and very pretty. They ate organic produce and wore organic cotton and drove their BMWs and Minis to Pilates after school. Their parents weren't stopping at McDonald's on the way home to pick up dinner before they went to do their second job on the night shift. These girls probably lived a life very similar to Emma Campano's. Shiny iPhones, new cars, beach vacations, and big-screen televisions. Faith caught herself, knowing that the small part of her who had lost so many things when Jeremy came along was acting up. It wasn't these girls' fault that they'd been born into wealthy families. They certainly didn't force their parents to buy them things. They were very lucky, and from the looks of them, very frightened. One of their schoolmates had been brutally murdered, more brutally than perhaps any of them would ever know. Another classmate was missing, probably being sadistically used by a monster. Between CSI and Thomas Harris, these kids could probably guess what was happening to Emma Campano. The closer Faith got to the stage, the more she could hear crying. There was nothing more emotional than a teenage girl. Whereas 10 minutes ago she had felt something akin to disdain for them, now Faith could only feel pity. McFadden took Faith by the arm. "That's Mrs. Clark," she said, pointing to a woman leaning against the far wall. Most of the teachers were standing in the aisle, diligently reprimanding students, keeping the peace in the large crowd. But Mary Clark seemed to be in her own little world. She was young, probably not long out of college, and bordering on beautiful. Her strawberry blonde hair hung to her shoulders, and freckles dotted her nose. Incongruously, she was dressed in a conservative black jacket, pressed white shirt and matching skirt that hit just below the knee, an outfit much more suitable for a matronly older woman. McFadden said, "If you could just say a few words to the students." Faith felt a surge of panic. She told herself that she was only speaking to a room full of kids, that it didn't matter if she made an ass of herself, but her hands were still shaking by the time they reached the front of the auditorium. The room was efficiently chilled by the air conditioning, but Faith found herself sweating. McFadden climbed the steps to the stage. Faith followed her, feeling the same age as the kids she was supposed to be assuring. While McFadden went straight to the podium, Faith stayed in the wings, desperate for any excuse not to have to do this. The lights were bright, so much so that Faith could only see the students sitting in the front row. Their uniforms were probably custom-tailored, schoolgirl skirts and matching starched white tops. The boys had fared better with dark pants and white shirts with blue-striped ties. It must have been an uphill battle every day to make them tuck in their shirts and keep their ties straightened. There were 6 chairs behind the podium. 4 of the chairs were filled with teachers, the last with a large, hairy man wearing spandex shorts and clutching a wrinkled piece of paper in his obviously sweaty hand. His gut rolled over the waist of his shorts, and sitting made it hard for him to breathe. His mouth was open, his lips moving like a fish. Faith studied him, trying to figure out what he was doing, and realized that he was going over the lines from a script in his beefy hand. Faith guessed by the whistle around his neck that he was head coach for the physical education department. Beside him was Evan Bernard, sitting in the last chair on the left. Daniela Park was in the last chair on the opposite end. Faith noted the distance between the two teachers and guessed from the way they were studiously avoiding each other's gaze that there was some tension between them. She glanced out at Mary Clark, who was still standing in the aisle,
and guessed that might be the reason.
This ends Disc 4. Fractured, Disc 5.
McFadden was checking the mic. Hushes went around the room, then the usual feedback through the sound system and the predictable murmur through the crowd. The principal waited for the noise to die down.
"We are all aware of the tragedy that struck two of our students and one of their friends yesterday. This is a trying time for all of us. But as a whole, we will overcome this tragedy and make something good of it. Our shared sense of community, our love for our fellow students, our respect for life and the common good will help all of us at Westfield persevere."
There was a scattering of applause, mostly from the parents. She turned to Faith.
"A detective from the Atlanta Police Department is here to take some of your questions. I would remind students to please be respectful to our guest."
McFadden sat down, and Faith felt every eye in the room scrutinize her as she walked across the stage. The podium seemed to get farther away with each step, and by the time she reached it, her hands were sweaty enough to leave marks on the polished wood.
"Thank you,"
Faith said, her voice sounding thin and girlish as it echoed through the speakers.
"I'm Detective Faith Mitchell. I want to assure you that the police are doing everything they can to find Emma, to find out who committed these crimes." She threw in, "and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation."
Too late, realizing that her sentence didn't make much sense. She tried again.
"As I said, I'm a detective with the Atlanta Police Department. Your principal has my direct phone number. If any of you saw anything, heard anything, or have any information that might help the case, then please contact me."
Faith realized her lungs were out of air. She tried to take a breath without making it obvious. Briefly, she wondered if this was what it felt like to have a heart attack.
"Ma'am?"
someone called. Faith shielded her eyes against the bright stage lights. She saw that several hands were up. She pointed to the closest girl, concentrating all of her attention on the one person instead of the crowd of onlookers.
"Yes?"
The student stood, and then Faith noticed her long blonde hair and creamy white skin. The question came to Faith's mind before the girl got it out.
"Do you think we should cut our hair?"
Faith swallowed, trying to think of the best way to answer. There were all kinds of urban legends about women with long hair being more likely to be targeted by rapists. But as far as Faith's practical experience had shown, the men who committed these crimes only cared about one thing on a woman's body, and it was not whether or not she had short or long hair. On the other hand, Kayla and Emma looked so much alike that it could certainly point to a trend. Faith skirted the question.
"You don't need to cut your hair. You don't need to change your appearance."
"How about—" someone began, then stopped, remembering protocol and raising her hand.
"Yes,"
Faith asked. The girl stood. She was tall and pretty, her dark hair hanging around her shoulders. There was a slight tremble to her voice when she asked,
"Emma and Kayla were both blonde. I mean, doesn't that mean that the guy has an M.O.?"
Faith felt caught out by the question. She thought about Jeremy and the way that he could always tell when she was not being honest with him.
"I'm not going to lie to you," she told the girl, then looked up at the group as a whole, her stage fright dissipating, her voice feeling stronger. "Yes, both Emma and Kayla had long blonde hair. If it makes you feel more comfortable to wear your hair up for a while, then do it. Don't let yourself believe, though, that this means you are perfectly safe. You still need to take precautions when you're out. You need to make sure your parents know where you are at all times."
There were whispers of protest. Faith held up her hands, feeling like a preacher.
"I know that sounds trite, but you guys aren't living in the suburbs. You know the basic rules of safety. Don't talk to strangers. Don't go to unfamiliar places alone. Don't go off on your own without letting someone, anyone, know where you are going and when you'll be back."
That seemed to mollify them. Most of the hands went down. Faith called on a boy sitting with his mother.
He spoke timidly. Is there anything we can do for Emma?
The room went completely silent. The fear started to creep back in.
As I said, she had to stop to clear her throat. As I said before, any information you can think of that might help us would be appreciated. Suspicious characters around school, unusual things Emma or Kayla might have said, or even usual things, something that maybe you are now thinking might be connected to what happened to them. All of that, no matter how trivial it may seem, is very valuable to us.
She cleared her throat, wishing she had some water.
As for anything you can personally do, I would ask again that you remember safety. Make sure that your parents know where you are at all times. Make sure that you take basic precautions. The fact is, we have no idea how this connects to your school, or even if it connects at all. I think vigilance is the key word here.
She felt slightly idiotic saying the words, thinking she sounded like a bad ripoff of Olivia McFadden, but the nods from both parents and students in the audience made Faith think that she had actually done some good here. She scanned the crowd. No more hands were up that she could see. With a nod toward the principal, Faith walked back across the stage and took her place in the wings.
Thank you, Detective Mitchell.
McFadden was back at the podium. She told the students,
in a few minutes, Coach Bob is going to do a 10-minute presentation followed by an instructional film on personal safety.
Faith suppressed a groan, only to hear it echo around the auditorium. McFadden continued,
after Coach Bob, Dr. Madison, who is, as you know, our school counselor, will have some remarks to make about dealing with tragedy. He will also be taking questions, so please remember, any questions you have should be saved up until Dr. Madison is finished speaking. Now, if we could all just take a moment to quietly reflect on our fellow students, those among us and those who are gone.
She waited a few seconds, then, when no one reacted, she said,
bow your heads, please.
Faith had never been a fan of the moment of silence, especially when it required head bowing. She liked it almost as much as public speaking, which took a close second to eating live cockroaches. Faith scanned the crowd, looking past the bowed heads to Mary Clark, who was staring blankly at the stage. As quietly as possible, Faith made her way down the stage stairs. She could almost feel Olivia McFadden's disapproval as she sneaked down the side aisle, but Faith wasn't one of the woman's students. And frankly, she had more important things to do than stand in the wings, listening to Coach Bob drill students about their safety for the next 10 minutes. Mary Clark stood straighter as she realized Faith was heading her way. If the teacher was surprised to find herself singled out, she didn't show it. As a matter of fact, she seemed relieved when Faith nodded toward the door. Mary didn't stop in the hallway, but pushed on through the exit before Faith could stop her. She went outside and stood on the concrete pad, hands on her hips, as she took deep breaths of fresh air. She told Faith,
I saw McFadden pointing me out before you started, and I was sure she was telling you that she was going to fire me.
Faith thought this was a strange way to open up a conversation, but it seemed like the sort of inappropriate remark she was capable of making herself.
Why would she fire you? My class is too noisy. I'm not strict enough. I don't adhere to the curriculum.
Mary Clark gave a forced laugh.
We have very different educational philosophies.
I need to talk to you about Kayla Alexander. She looked over her shoulder.
Not Emma?
Her face fell.
Oh, no. Is she...
No, Faith assured her. We haven't found her yet. Her hands covered her mouth.
I thought...
She wiped away her tears. They both knew what she had thought, and Faith felt like an ass for not being more clear to begin with.
She said, I'm sorry.
Mary pulled a tissue out of her jacket pocket and blew her nose.
God, I thought I was finished crying.
Did you know Emma?
Not really, but she's a student here. They all feel like they're your responsibility.
She blew her nose.
You were terrified up there, weren't you?
Yes, Faith admitted, because lying about something so simple
would make it harder to lie about bigger things later on.
I hate public speaking.
I do too,
Mary amended. Well, not in front of kids. They don't really matter, but in faculty meetings, parent-teacher conferences. She shook her head.
God, what does any of that matter to you, right? Why don't I say something about the weather?
Faith leaned against the steel door but thought better of it when her flesh started to blister.
Why weren't you in the meeting this morning?
She tucked the tissue back into her pocket.
My opinion isn't exactly valued around here.
Teaching was a profession famous for producing burnout. Faith could well imagine the old guard did not appreciate an idealistic young kid coming in to change the world. Mary Clark said as much.
They all think it's just a matter of time before I run screaming out the door.
You had Kayla Alexander in your class last year. The younger woman turned around, arms crossed over her chest, and studied Faith. There was something hostile about the stance. Faith asked,
"Can you tell me what happened?"
Mary was dubious.
"They didn't tell you?"
"No." She gave another laugh.
"Typical."
Faith was silent, giving the other woman space.
Mary asked, "Did they tell you that last year Kayla was so mean to one of the other girls that she ended up leaving school?"
"No."
"Ruth Donner. She transferred to Marist in the middle of last year.
Daniela Park said that Kayla split the school in two."
"That's a fair statement."
"There was the Kayla camp and the Ruth camp. It took a while, but pretty soon more and more people went over to Ruth's side. Transferring out was the smartest thing she did, really. It put Kayla center stage, and suddenly the cracks started to show. I think it's fair to say that by the beginning of the school year, Kayla was universally reviled."
"Except for Emma."
"Except for Emma."
"I'm hardly an expert, but don't girls usually outgrow that kind of behavior in middle school?"
"Usually," the teacher confirmed. "But some of them hang on to it. The really mean ones can't stop circling once they smell blood in the water."
Faye thought the shark analogy was a good one.
"Where is Ruth Donner now?"
"College, I suppose.
She was a senior."
"Finding her would certainly be a priority."
"Kayla would have been a junior last year. What was she doing going after a senior?"
"Ruth was the most popular girl in school."
She shrugged, as if that explained everything.
"Of course, there weren't any ramifications for Kayla. She gets away with everything."
Faith tried to tread carefully. There was something else to this story. Mary Clark was giving off the distinct impression that she felt as if she was being asked questions that Faith already knew the answers to. "I understand that what happened with the other girl was horrible, but this feels very personal for you." Mary's hostility seemed to ratchet up a notch.
"I tried to fail Kayla Alexander last year."
Faith could guess what she meant by tried. Parents paid a lot of money for their kids to go to Westfield. They expected them to excel in their classes, even if their work did not warrant good grades.
"What happened?"
"We don't fail children here at Westfield Academy. I had to tutor the little bitch after school." The characterization was startling, considering the circumstances.
"I have to admit, Mrs. Clark, that I find it strange you would talk that way about a 17-year-old girl who's been raped and murdered."
"Please call me Mary." Faith was at a loss for words. Mary seemed just as nonplussed.
"They really didn't tell you what happened?"
Faith shook her head.
"I almost lost my job over her. I have student loans, two babies at home. My husband's trying to start his own business. I'm 28 years old, and the only thing I'm qualified to do is teach."
"Hold up," Faith stopped her. "Tell me what happened."
"Kayla showed up for tutoring, but short of me physically taking her hand and writing her papers for her, there was no way she was going to do the work she needed to do to pass the class."
Mary's neck showed a slight blush.
"We had an argument. I let my anger get the better part of me.
She paused, and Faith was expecting the woman to admit to some sort of physical altercation, but what she said was far more shocking.
The next day, Olivia called me into her office. Kayla was there with her parents. She accused me of making a sexual pass at her.
Faith's surprise must have registered on her face.
"Oh, don't be fooled by the schoolmarm before you," Mary said. "I used to dress a lot better than this, like a human being, almost. I dressed too sexy, according to our illustrious principal. I suppose that's her way of saying I asked for it."
"Back up," Faith said. "I don't understand. Kayla Alexander said that I told her she would pass my class if she had sex with me."
She was smiling, but there was nothing funny about what was coming out of her mouth.
"I suppose I should have been flattered. I was 3 months out from giving birth to twins. I barely fit into any of my clothes, and I couldn't afford new ones because teaching is supposed to be its own reward. I started lactating during the meeting. The parents were screaming at me. Olivia just sat there, letting it all play out like her own personal movie."
Angry tears streamed down her cheeks.
"I've wanted to be a teacher since I was a little girl. I wanted to help people. Nobody does this for the money, and it's certainly not for the respect. I tried to get through to her. I thought I was getting through to her, and all she did was turn around and stab me in the back."
Is this what Daniela Park really meant when she said Kayla had split the school?
Danny was one of the few teachers on staff who believed me.
Why wouldn't they believe you?
Kayla is extremely good at manipulating people, men especially.
Faith remembered Evan Bernard, the easy way he had dismissed Mary Clark.
What happened?
There was an investigation. Thank God those stupid cameras are everywhere. She had no proof because it didn't happen. And she's not the brightest bulb to begin with. First she said I propositioned her in my room, then she said it was in the parking lot, then it was behind the school. Her story kept changing every day.
In the end, it was my word against hers. She gave a tight grin.
I ran into her in the hallway a few days later.
Do you know what she said? Can't blame a girl for trying.
Why was she allowed to stay in school?
Mary did a perfect imitation of Olivia McFadden.
Here at Westfield, we pride ourselves on nurturing the special needs of what society labels more difficult children. At $14,000 a year, plus athletic fees, student activity fees, and uniforms.
Except for the ending, these were the exact same words the principal had used less than an hour ago.
The parents didn't have a problem with that?
Kayla's been kicked out of every other school in town. It was Westfield or the Atlanta public school system.
Trust me, I've met the parents. The Alexanders were much more horrified by the prospect of their precious daughter mixing with the great unwashed than they were about sending her to school with a woman who allegedly tried to molest her.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Her tone had a bitter clip.
Me too.
I have to ask you, Mary. Do you know of anyone who would want to kill Kayla?
Other than me?
She asked. No humor at the question.
My planning period is at the end of the day, she said, referring to her time off to grade papers and prepare lesson plans. I had a classroom full of kids from 8 o'clock on.
Anyone else?
She chewed her lip, really thinking about it.
No, she finally said. I can't think of anyone who would do something so horrible, even to a monster like Kayla Alexander.
Chapter 8. Will sat outside the Campano house, listening to Evan Bernard's tinny voice coming out of the digital recorder. The sound quality was horrible, and Will had to hold the machine against his ear, the volume at the highest level, to make out the man's words. "It's not a disease, Mr. Trent. It's a wiring problem in the brain." Will wondered if Paul Campano had been told this information. Had he believed it? Or had he done the same thing to his child as he had to Will?
He put the recorder in his pocket as he got out of the car, knowing this line of thinking contributed nothing toward finding Emma Campano. A cop from the day before was standing in the driveway, hands on his hips. He had obviously been doing a good job because the scrum of reporters waiting for news from the Campano home were cordoned well across the street. They still shouted questions as Will walked past the cop. The man didn't acknowledge Will, and Will returned the courtesy as he went up the drive. Charlie Reed's van was parked in front of the carriage house. The back doors were open, showing a mini-lab that had been fitted into the shell of the van. Boxes of plastic evidence bags and examined gloves. Various tools, medical-grade vacuums, and specimen vials were neatly stacked on the ground by the bumper. Charlie was inside, cataloging each piece of evidence into a laptop before locking it into a cage that was welded to the floor. If this case ever made it to court, the chain of evidence had to be clearly defined, or the forensic part of the prosecution would fall to the wayside. "Hey," Will said, leaning on the open door. "I'm glad you're here. I've got to ask the father for a DNA sample. Can you do the swab?"
"Are you kidding me?"
Charlie asked.
"He's going to go apeshit."
"Yeah," Will agreed. "Amanda wants it, though."
"It's funny how she has no qualms about putting our necks on the line."
Will shrugged. You couldn't argue with the truth.
"You find anything in the house?" "Actually, yes."
Charlie sounded mildly surprised.
"I found a fine powder on the floor in the foyer."
"What kind of powder?" Charlie traced his finger along a set of plastic vials and plucked one out.
"Dirt, I guess, but it's not our famous red Georgia clay."
Will took the vial and held it between his thumb and forefinger, thinking he could be holding an ounce of cocaine, except that the grainy powder in this case was a dark gray rather than white. "Where'd you find it?"
"Some was embedded in the entrance rug, some at the corner of the stairs."
"That's the only two places?"
"Yep."
"Did you check Adam's shoes and the flip-flops upstairs?" Charlie picked at his mustache, twirling the end.
"If you're asking me whether or not I found the powder in an area that wasn't trampled on by you, Amanda, and the Atlanta Police Department, no. It was only in those two spots, on the rug and by the stairs."
Will was afraid that was going to be his answer.
Even if the powder led them to a suspect, then the defense could always argue that the evidence should be excluded because the police had contaminated the scene. If Charlie or Will were on the witness stand, both men would have to admit to the likelihood that they could have just as easily brought in the evidence on the soles of their own shoes. Juries like to be told a story. They wanted to know all the steps the police took between finding the evidence and finding a suspect. Being told that a certain man carried into the crime scene a certain substance on his shoes painted a very pretty picture. The prosecution would be hamstrung if they couldn't mention a key piece of evidence pointed them toward the killer. Of course, none of that would really matter if Emma Campana was found alive. They were coming up on 24 hours since the girl had been taken. Each minute that passed made it less likely she would be found. Will shook the vial, seeing darker specks in the gray powder.
"What do you think it is?"
"That's the million-dollar question," he added, literally,
not needing to remind Will that analyzing the powder would be a costly test. Unlike Hollywood Dream Labs, it was very rare for a state laboratory to be equipped with all the cutting-edge computers and microscopes that made it so easy for the heroes to solve crimes in under an hour. They had two choices: send the sample to the FBI and pray they could get to it, or shell out the money for a private lab to do the analysis. Will felt the heat catch up with him, sweat rolling down the back of his neck.
"How important do you think this is?"
Charlie shrugged.
"I'd just collect some, boss."
Will asked, "Do you have another one of these?"
"Yep, one for each location."
He put it to another vial in the tray.
"You've got the sample from the rug, so it's more likely to have cross-contamination."
Charlie gave him a curious look.
"What are you going to do?"
If he hadn't been to Georgia Tech the day before, Will probably wouldn't have even considered it. "Beg somebody to test it for free." Charlie advised,
This is a hell of a lot more complicated than letting you have that key yesterday. A key either fits a certain lock or doesn't. With the powder, it's all down to one person's interpretation. We have to document everything. I've got a form you can take with you. He rummaged around in the van and pulled out a yellow sheet of paper. This is a sign-in sheet. You're going to need a witness every step of the way. First, I need you to sign a release saying you've taken the sample. He found another form, attached it to a clipboard, and offered it to Will. I've got the other sample if you hit on something. We can always run it through a lab to confirm whatever you find. Will stared at the form, finding the X in the straight line. His signature was the one thing he could manage without having to think about it, but that wasn't the problem. If there was a geological characteristic to the sample that pointed to a specific location, then that might give them an area to search for Emma Campano. Will tried to keep his tone even, but he felt a tingling at the base of his spine, like he was walking perilously close to the edge of a steep cliff. The defense could argue that anybody brought in the powder. If we make an arrest off a lab analysis, and the judge says the analysis can't be used, the killer could walk away free. Charlie lowered the clipboard.
Yes, that's true.
But if we just happen to find the girl... He returned to his computer, tapping the keys to wake it up. Will turned around, checking on the cop at the end of the driveway. The man still had his back turned to them. And he was at least 20 feet away, but still, Will lowered his voice when he asked Charlie, "Have you cataloged this yet?"
"Nope."
He scanned the barcode on an evidence bag and tapped some more keys. Will tightened his hand around the vial, which fit neatly into the palm of his hand. He had never been the kind of cop to bend the rules. But if there was a way to find the girl, how could it be right for him to stand idly by? Charlie said,
"Did you see the Toxic Shocks are battling it out with the Dixie Derby girls this weekend?"
Will had to repeat the words in his head before he understood their meaning. Charlie was a big fan of women's competitive roller derby. "No, I didn't see that.
It's going to be a real knockout."
Will hesitated. He checked the cop at the end of the driveway again before putting the sample in his pants pocket. "Thanks, Charlie."
"Don't mention it."
He turned to face Will.
"Okay?"
Will gave a quick nod. "I'll let you know when you can swab the dad." Charlie gave a sarcastic,
"Great. Thanks."
Will tucked his hand into his pocket, wrapping his fingers around the vial as he walked to the carriage house. He was really sweating now, though the temperature wasn't in the unbearable range yet. There had been times in Will's career when he had walked the tightrope between right and wrong, but he had never done something so blatantly illegal and desperate. Not that it made a bit of difference, but nothing was breaking on this case. They were a day into it, and there were no witnesses, no suspects, and nothing to go on but the gray powder that may or may not lead to anything but Will getting fired from his job. He had actually stolen evidence from a crime scene. Not only that, but he had implicated Charlie in the process. What gave Will the most trouble was the hypocrisy involved. The disapproving cop standing guard in the Campano driveway suddenly had the moral high ground.
"Will!"
Amish Patel was sitting at the top of the steps that led to the apartment over the garage. He held a cigarette between his thumb and forefinger. Will took his hand out of his pocket as he climbed the stairs.
"How's it going?"
"All right, I guess. I've got the computer hooked up to the phone line, but nothing's come in. Mostly they've been getting calls from family and neighbors. The father's been pretty abrupt with them, and no one's called this morning."
"And the family?"
"The mother's been in the bedroom pretty much from the get-go. A doctor came in this morning to check on her, but she refused sedation. Hoyt Bentley was here most of the night, but he left around an hour ago. The father left a few times, too, but mostly he just sat at the bottom of the stairs. He got the morning paper from the end of the driveway before I could stop him."
"What about his parents?"
"I think they're dead."
Will rubbed his jaw. He felt an odd sort of loss at the news. At the home, the older a child got, the less likely he was to be adopted. Paul had been 12
when his foster parents had petitioned the court to make it official. They had all waited for him to be returned like an ugly tie or a broken toaster. When Will himself left at 18, they were still waiting. From nowhere, Amish said, "I have to say, man, that Abigail Campano is one good-looking woman." The inappropriate observation wasn't altogether a surprise. Amish was one of those cops who liked to put on a front as if the job was just a job. Still, Will said, "I thought it was against your religion to covet other men's wives." He flicked ash off his cigarette. "Southern Baptist, baby. Jesus already forgave me." Amish indicated the pool area, which looked like an oasis in the backyard. "You mind if I take a break while you're in with them? I've been here all night. I could use a change of scenery." "Go ahead." Will knocked lightly on the door, then let himself in. The main room of the apartment was large, with a full kitchen on one side and the living room on the other. He guessed the bedroom and bathroom were behind the closed doors at the rear of the room. Amish Patel's laptop was set up on the kitchen table, waiting for the phone to ring. Two sets of headphones were hooked into an old-fashioned tape machine that was the size of a cement block. Paul was sitting on the couch, his hand on the remote control. The television was muted, but the closed captioning scrolled across the screen. Will recognized the CNN logo in the corner. The reporter was standing in front of a weather map, her arms waving as she described a storm system moving across the Midwest. The coffee table was littered with newspapers, USA Today, The Atlanta Journal, printouts of other papers that Paul must have gotten off the internet. Will couldn't read the headlines, but all of them showed the same school photographs of Emma, Adam, and Kayla. "Trash," Paul said. Will didn't know whether or not to correct him. The man's daughter was missing. Was now really the time to dig up old grudges? "They're fucking idiots," Paul said, waving the remote at the TV. "2 days now, and they're still saying the same damn thing with different graphics." "You shouldn't watch that," Will told him. "Why haven't you put us on TV?" he demanded. "That's what they always do on the cop shows. They show the parents so the kidnapper knows that she has a family." Will was more concerned with getting Emma back than worrying about what cop shows dictated as standard procedure. Besides, the press was there to ravage the Campanos, not to help them. Will was under enough stress from the media without setting up the parents for an on-camera meltdown. The last time Will had seen Abigail Campano, she had been sedated into a fog and could barely open her mouth without sobbing. Paul was a ticking time bomb, waiting for the smallest provocation to set him off. Putting either of them on television would be a disaster, and would invariably cause the press, absent any real information, to start pointing the finger right back at the parents. Will told him, "We're not talking to the press right now. Anytime you want information, you should come to us." He snorted a laugh, throwing the remote under the coffee table. "Yeah, y'all have been real forthcoming." "What do you think you haven't been told?" Paul barked a laugh. "Where the fuck my daughter is? Why nobody noticed they had the wrong fucking body? How the fuck you wasted a whole fucking hour sitting with your thumbs up your asses while my fucking baby was being..." He lost his steam, his eyes filling with tears, his jaw clenched as he stared at the television set. "I just came from Emma's school," Will said, wishing he had more information. "We've been talking to her teachers, her friends. We spent most of the day yesterday at Georgia Tech tracking down Adam Humphrey." "And what did you find out?" "Jack shit." "I know you've hired your own people to work on this, Paul." "That's none of your fucking business." "It is, because they could get in my way." "Your way? You think I give a shit about getting in your way?" He pointed to the newspapers on the coffee table. "You know what they're saying?" "Of course you don't fucking know what they're saying, do you?" He stood up. "They're saying you're incompetent. Your own people are saying that you fucked up the crime scene, that any evidence was lost because you didn't know what the fuck you were doing." Will couldn't think of a way to explain to him the difference between the Atlanta Police Department and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation without sounding like a condescending twat. He settled on saying, "Paul, I'm in charge of this investigation now. You should know..." "Know what?" In seconds, he closed the space between the two of them.
You think I'm going to trust you to find my little girl? I know you, trash can. Did you forget that?
Will had flinched when he'd charged, like he was 10 years old again, like he wasn't 6 inches taller and 10 times stronger than the asshole in front of him. Paul shook his head, a look of open disgust on his face.
Just get the fuck out of here and let the grown-ups do their job.
You don't know a damn thing about me.
Paul pushed the newspaper off the coffee table, finding a sheet of notebook paper.
What does this say, retard?
He shoved the papers in Will's face.
Can you read this? You asked for a list of Emma's friends. Can you even fucking read it?
Will tilted up his chin, staring down at Paul. I need a DNA sample from you to compare with the specimens we took from Kayla Alexander's vagina and the sheets in your daughter's bedroom.
Motherfucker!
Paul swung wildly, and even though Will had been expecting it, he still lost his balance. Both of them fell back onto the floor. Paul had the superior position, but he was older and slower. Will deflected his strikes, relishing the feel of his fist in Paul's soft gut. He punched him in the kidney, then gave him another jab to the stomach. The door flew open, popping against the wall.
Will! Hamish yelled. Jesus Christ!
Will literally felt himself come back to his senses. His hearing was first. Hamish's panicked voice, a woman screaming. Pain came next. Spreading across the bridge of his nose, he tasted blood in his mouth, smelled Paul's sour breath as the man rolled off Will and onto the floor. Both men lay on their backs, panting. Will tried to move, feeling something crunch in his back pocket. No one seemed to notice the phone was ringing until Abigail Campano cried,
"It's Kayla! It's Kayla's cell phone calling!"
The woman was holding the telephone in her hand, eyes glued to the caller ID. Both Will and Paul scrambled to stand. Hamish ran to his computer. He held up a finger, telling Abigail to wait while he pressed the keys. Will slipped on the extra set of headphones as Hamish donned his own pair. He nodded, and Abigail answered the phone, holding the receiver so that Paul could listen in.
"Hello?"
There was static, then a garbled voice that was electronically altered to a menacing monotone.
"Is this the mother?"
Abigail's mouth opened. But she wasn't speaking. She stared at Hamish for a cue. He nodded, writing something on a dry erase board in front of him.
"Yes," she stuttered. "This is Emma's mother. Is Emma all right? Can I talk to Emma?"
Hamish must have coached her to use her daughter's name as much as she could. It was harder to kill somebody who had a name. The voice said,
"I have your daughter."
Hamish wrote something down, and Abigail nodded as she said,
"What do you want? Tell me how to get Emma back."
There was more static. The voice had no inflection, no accent.
"I want $1 million.
"Okay,"
she agreed. Hamish started furiously writing on the board.
"When? Where?" she begged. "Just tell me what you want."
"I will call you tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. with details."
"No, wait," she cried. "How do I know she's alive? How do I know Emma's alive?"
Will pressed his fingers into the earphones, his ears straining to hear past the static. He heard clicking, but didn't know if that was from Hamish pressing keys on his computer or something else. They all startled in unison as the sound jumped up several levels.
"Daddy,"
a girl's voice said, tired, terrified.
"Daddy, please, help me."
"Baby," Paul screamed. "Baby, it's me."
There was another click, then the line went dead.
"Emma?"
Abigail yelled.
"Hello?"
Hamish tapped the keys on his computer, working furiously to keep the line engaged. He shook his head at Will. Nothing.
"What do we do now?"
Abigail begged, fear pitching her voice up almost as high as her daughter's.
"What do we do?"
"We pay the bastard," Paul glared at Will. "I want you out of my house. Take him with you."
Hamish looked startled, but Will shook his head, indicating that the man should stay put. He told Paul, "You can't negotiate with the kidnapper on your own."
"What the fuck do I need you for? You can't even trace the fucking call."
"Paul,"
Abigail tried, but he cut her off.
"Get out of my fucking house, now!"
When Will did not move, Paul stepped forward, crowding the space.
"Don't think I won't beat your ass again."
"Why do you want me to leave?"
Will asked. "So you can call your private security firm and they can tell you what to do?" You didn't have to be able to read to see the answer in Paul's eyes. The more people you get involved in this, the more people who try to control it, the more likely it's going to be that something bad happens to Emma.
You think I'm going to trust my daughter's life to you?
I think you need to stop for just a minute and realize that I am the only person you've got who knows how to keep her safe right now.
Then I'm fucked, ain't I?
Paul's lips drew into a sneer.
You stupid piece of shit, get the fuck out of my house.
Please,
Abigail murmured. Paul persisted.
Get out of my goddamn house!
It's my house, too,
Abigail countered, her voice stronger.
I want them to stay.
Paul told her, you don't know.
I know that they're the police, Paul. They know what they're doing. They deal with this kind of thing all...
Her voice started to tremble again. She clutched her hands in front of her, nervously gripping the phone that had just brought her daughter's voice back to life.
He said he'll call back tomorrow. We need their help. We need them to tell us what to do when he calls.
Paul shook his head.
Stay out of this, Abby.
She's my daughter, too.
Just let me take care of this,
he pleaded, though it was obvious his wife's mind was already made up.
I can handle this, the same way you handle everything else.
The room went silent. Even the fan on Hamish's computer stopped spinning. Abigail did not seem concerned that she had an audience.
Where were you, Paul? How did you handle it when Emma started hanging around Kayla?
That's not...
You said she was just acting out. That she was just being a teenager. To leave her alone. Look where leaving her alone got her. She sure as hell is alone now.
Paul was wholly unconvincing when he mumbled,
She was just being a kid.
She was?
Abigail repeated.
You're still spouting that same parental wisdom? Just let her figure things out on her own, you said. Just let her sow some wild oats. Just like you did at that age, only look at you now. You're just a pathetic, needy bastard who can't even keep his daughter safe.
I know you're upset,
Paul said, sounding like the reasonable one.
Let's just talk about this later.
That's exactly what you told me, she insisted. Time and time again, you said, we'd just talk about it later. Emma skipped school, we'll talk about it later. Emma's failing English, talk about it later. Later, later, later. It's later!
She threw the phone across the room, smashing it into pieces against the wall.
It's later, Paul. Do you want to talk about it now? Do you want to tell me how I'm overreacting? How I'm the crazy one, I'm the overprotective one, how I just need to calm down and let kids be kids?
Her voice caught.
Are you calm, Paul? Are you calm while you're thinking about what that man, that animal, is doing to our daughter?
All of the color drained from Paul's face.
Don't say that. You know what he's doing to her, she hissed. You always said she was your beautiful girl. Do you think you're the only man who thinks that? Do you think you're the only man who can't control himself around hot young blondes?
Paul glanced at Will nervously, telling him,
Get out.
Don't,
Abigail told Will.
I want you to hear this. I want you to know how my loving and devoted husband screws every 20-year-old who crosses his path.
She indicated her face, her body.
It's the car salesman in him. Every time one model gets out of date, he trades up to the newer one.
Abigail, this isn't the time.
When is the time?
She demanded.
When is it time for you to fucking grow up and admit that you are wrong?
Her fury heightened with each word.
I trusted you. I trusted you to keep us safe. I looked the other way because I knew that at the end of the day, you would always come back home to me.
I did.
I do.
He was trying to soothe her, but Will could see it only made her angrier.
Abby, don't say my name, she screamed, throwing her fists into the air. Don't speak to me. Don't look at me. Don't say a goddamn word to me until my daughter is home.
She ran toward the front door, slamming it behind her. Will heard her footsteps as she ran down the steps. When he looked out the window, he could see her on her knees in the grass, bending over the waist as she keened.
Get out,
Paul said. His chest was heaving up and down as if the wind had been knocked out of him.
Please. Just for now, both of you. Just please get out.
Chapter 9. Faith stood outside the morgue, her finger pressed into one ear to block out the noise as she talked to Ruth Donner on her cell phone. Tracking down Kayla Alexander's former nemesis had been somewhat easier than speaking in front of a group of terrified teenagers. In retrospect, Olivia McFadden's relieving her of the podium had been somewhat reminiscent of Travis and Old Yeller in the woodshed. Still, Faith had managed to persuade Olivia McFadden to put her in touch with Ruth Donner's mother. The woman had given Faith an earful about Kayla Alexander, then volunteered her daughter's cell phone number. Ruth was a student at Colorado State. She was studying early childhood education. She wanted to be a schoolteacher.
I couldn't believe it was Kayla, Ruth said. It's been all over the news here.
Anything you could think of would help, Faith said, raising her voice over the whir of a bone saw.